Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We're joined today by Sar Rudenklau, founder of Cursive Media. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah. Great to be here.
Good to be. And we're doing it live today. We're in our new podcast studio at our co-working space. We're testing it out. So we're very excited to have an in-person guest.
Smells box fresh in here. Yeah,
new car smell.
Yeah.
New car smell.
Yeah.
Today we're going to be talking about building visibility for underrepresented founders. That's something that is near and dear to Literal Humans' cause as we've started our business. We're B Corp, we're good brands and charities and things like that. And we work with a lot of founders who are, I like to say, underestimated. You know what I mean? That's one of our clients gave us that. So that's from, shout out to Camelback Ventures. But it's an important issue. So I'm glad that we can tackle it. Sar Rudenklau is the founder of Cursive Media, a strategic communications agency that works specifically with underrepresented and underestimated B2B founders and C-suite executives to transform them into influential thought leaders. Very timely for us because we're sort of building, you know, founder branding sort of vertical, working with a couple founders in the AI space. So we're going to have a lot to talk about. Through deep strategy, authentic storytelling, and relentless advocacy, Cursive helps visionary leaders build executive brands that drive real business results. And what really resonates with us is your emphasis on human connection. That's something that we really think, like, everyone on our team is trained in behavior science, and we really think about, you know, the human psychology and everything we do. And it constantly shocks us that marketers don't think about that more and integrate that into their practice. So super excited to dig into that with you. Sar believes that in a world of AI-generated content, showing up as a real human with real vision is more important than ever. And that's something actually we're over-indexing on too, is that, you know, as AI rises, what about HI? What about human intelligence and just how that will change and become more important? So yeah, let's jump in. So first question, the executive branding and thought leadership that, you know, has become, that space in general has become incredibly crowded. And especially with AI, it's easier to kind of just like churn out content and call it thought leadership, right? So if you could walk us through how the landscape of executive branding has shifted, and particularly for underrepresented founders, and how Cursive and the work that you're diving into positions itself in that crowded space.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it has and it hasn't changed. Yes, it has changed. The elephant in the room is AI, of course. Yep. And like you said, it's easier than ever to churn out a lot of content. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I say to all my clients and my team as well, like, if you didn't bother writing it, why should I bother? It's a human to human decency.
But what if you influence its writing? You know, like, that's where I think people get
That's where out. I think we're all still figuring out what that actually means. Sure. So I love AI. I use it every single day.
Yeah.
But I'm very, very conscious of in my day to day, not using it to replace critical thought.
Totally. Yeah.
It's an accelerator for things like, I don't have a data mind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So being able to feed it facts and figures and get some kind of like head start on getting some insights from it, great. When it comes to thought leadership, you made a really good point that being the human in the room is even more important now. Mm-hmm. Like having an authentic voice, that bit hasn't changed mm-hmm. when it comes to executive brand. Yep. That has always been the foundational principle. It is even more important now.
Mm-hmm.
That human connection, I think, side note, hot take, I think in-person events over the next couple of years are going to go through the roof. But yeah, I think that has become even more important. So really Cursive, my strategy behind building Cursive is to really lean into that human-to-human connection.
Yeah.
We're keeping our organization really small so we can be super hands-on with our founders and really understand them as humans. And then use AI to augment on a like systems and operational side.
Okay. Let's define some terms for our audience. So you said B2B, like any specific sectors you're concentrating on within B2B?
Not really. Okay. No, pretty open. We lean a little bit more towards healthcare, which is just like just circumstantial at the moment. Yep. But we cover pretty much the full gamut.
Okay. And then when you say, how do you define underrepresented? Like what's your criteria as you're accepting applications from founders who want to work with you?
Yeah, I mean it's a really good question.
Yeah.
I think I lean on I'm trying to be diplomatic here.
Yeah, sure.
I lean on things like I look at just saw some data about VC funding.
Uh-huh.
From last year, came out earlier this year.
Yeah.
And it was something like 84% of global VC funding went to all male teams.
Yeah.
Less than 2.5% went to women-only teams.
Yes, yeah. And then break that down by Black women, break that down by disabled women. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Like that is, and that is not to say there are not incredible women out there going for VC funding, but they just have to work so much harder.
Totally.
I'm guilty of it. We are all guilty of it, of taking people on face value.
Totally, yeah.
And going, this is what a founder looks like. Yeah. He's a white dude in his 30s in a hoodie.
Yeah. Yeah, because you, as a VC, they're just like, all right, what's the fastest path to, you know, ROI, you know?
And, exactly.
And like, they see someone who looks like them, and they've only been in that space, and they've gone to business school, and they're like, okay, yeah, this guy probably is going to lead us to ROI. And it just like becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And they are VCs for want speed. They want scale, and especially in the US. Like, scale is their number one thing.
Totally.
So it makes total sense from their point of view. So to me, going back to your original question, underrepresented means a bunch of things. It means like the voices that don't have the opportunity to rise to the top because they don't have that systemic backing.
Yep.
The voices that you don't, or the faces that you don't necessarily see shouting on LinkedIn.
Yeah, shouting on LinkedIn.
We all know what that means.
Yeah, totally.
They're the people that I think we have the biggest opportunity and the biggest responsibility to really amplify as well.
Okay. And talk us through like more, what are some of the specific challenges other than just being sort of underestimated and you know, some of the stuff you mentioned, like what are specific challenges that you're seeing with B2B founders when they're trying to build their executive brand?
Do you know what? It's confidence.
Okay.
It's really like, it is the same pattern, and especially, I keep going back to women, but it's not exclusively for women. It's confidence.
Yeah.
Like an example is, I'm working with this really great clinical leader at the moment, and she started her career out as a nurse, worked in big hospital systems, very traditional nursing background. Then she went into more of a clinical operations role in a big enterprise org. And now she is in this really interesting health tech where she's sort of the bridge between clinical and engineering. And when we originally sat down, her first thing, the very first thing that came out of her mouth, and this is, she's in her early 40s. She has an incredible track record.
Yeah.
She has an incredible career. She's like, I don't think I have anything to offer here.
Yeah.
Are you insane?
And these are little people, they've already founded a business and they're like showing up to you being like, I you know, I'm not that confident in myself. Like, I'm not sure.
Right.
Like, it's just, yeah.
I don't know. She sort of said, like, if I write something, I don't know who would bother reading it. It was like that. Like, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I totally get it because it's when you're in something, it's very hard to sort of see yourself objectively. But once we sort of got talking and we realized that what she thought was a negative for her, having this really interesting non-linear career path and all these different sort of disparate experiences, that was actually her superpower.
Yeah.
So she can actually, we've zoomed her kind of thought leadership out to much more of an industry level. And we're building her profile as sort of a first do no harm commentator on AI in a clinical setting. Because she's seen it on so many different operational levels.
Right.
And she understands how clinicians work. So, and now we've been working together for almost eight months now.
Okay.
And
seeing success so far.
Speaking opportunities are coming to her. Media is now coming to her as an expert.
Yeah.
So like she is, and I'm seeing her confidence.
That's great.
So,
and talk to us a little bit about measurement. You mentioned a couple of things. So like, how do you measure the success of, you know, sort of executive branding, founder branding engagement? You mentioned media, you mentioned speaking engagements. Like what else? Yeah.
It's the, what we sometimes call vanity metrics.
Yeah, sure.
It's the followers and the engagement on social media. It's, but to me, it's a little bit more than that. It's engagement on a more conversational level.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what something that I train into my clients is,
we
can stick something on LinkedIn. But the real magic is when you engage with people who comment on it.
Totally.
And you start that conversation. So measuring it across like her depth and breadth of network as well.
Totally.
Really, really critical.
And like, I think the vanity metrics thing is interesting. And I love that you tied it from like followers engagement to like real conversations. And then eventually you can even start thinking about, okay, is my company making more money? Are they making more revenue?
Exactly.
Are they,
the
way that I've heard it said really nicely by a gentleman I work with is in the building, shout out to Chiesa, is that social capital is the precursor to financial capital.
Oh, I like that.
Right?
Oh, yeah, like, I'm going to steal that.
I know, you should.
Sorry.
Like, when he said that, and it's just like, it's so, I feel like some of the best sort of realizations are so blindingly simple, you know, and it's just like, like, of course you need to get this founder out there, meeting people, building authentic relationships, which will then lead to whatever, contracts, revenue, profitability, because it's just people working with people.
It goes back to the first part of this conversation. Yeah. People want to work with people.
People they like.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it does, and I think that too, like, doesn't just have to be people they like who look like them, right? And that's the kind of like breakthrough that, like, you know, I'm pushing forward, you're pushing forward, get there, don't worry. And so
we will get there. Yeah.
The way we're going to get there, question two, we're going to pivot to content. And you talk about, you know, premium strategically executed content that you can't find inside LLMs, which I think is written. And I think the content game has changed, right? Like it used to be like you can't do 101 basic how-to content anymore because the LLMs are handling that right now. So we're pivoting the exact same way. It's all about, you know, marketing guides and like expert, you know, subject matter expert opinions and things like that. So talk us through how this actually looks like in practice. How do you kind of, you know, ensure that you're creating authentic thought leadership and it's not just another, you know, another take on like polished marketing content that we all know and somewhat love?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll preface this with, I hate marketing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
I'm a marketer, but I don't like, you know, polished marketing content. So this has been a really fun kind of process for me to develop.
Yeah, yeah.
I take a very journalistic approach to it. So, I don't, unless they're seasoned writers, I generally don't expect my clients to write much.
Even if they're writing their LinkedIn posts, maybe they write, you know, memos for the team, like they're writing a lot.
They're if we sit down and we go, okay, we want to write a like 2,000 word thought leadership article on X, like staring at a blank Google Doc is really daunting. Anyone.
But PTSD thinking about.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, like I said, I take a very journalistic approach where we meet generally for an hour every 2 weeks, more often if I can, but you know, founders are busy. And I have like a running repository of headlines and white papers and just stuff that I kind of come across and kind of put into a bucket for them. Mm-hmm. And we sit down and we just jam on that. And I ask them, I'm a wannabe journalist. Yeah. I have very little journalistic training, put my journalist hat on and I just ask them questions about it. So what do you think about this? What do you think about that? So for example, going back to my clinical client, Samsung just acquired a wearables company called Zelf. I think it's called Zelf. X-E-A-L-T-H.
Some of these tech names, like, good luck. They all sound like, you know, drugs in the U.S., like, you know, like a Vivia, and they're like, a why?
Exactly, yeah. So I could go to her and say, okay, what do you think about this acquisition in the context of, like, where do wearables sit in a healthcare setting? So it's very much, like, balances that newsworthy aspect. Okay. Something is sort of a hot topic with her expertise.
Yeah, okay.
And from that, we can pull out from an hour conversation, out like usually 4, 5, 6 kind of threads that then we can build different types of content from.
Any example of like a piece of content you're particularly proud of that you've like worked with the founder to build, like to take their thought leadership and to turn it into something like compelling and punchy?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to keep using this client as an example because she's doing some really exciting stuff, and we're experimenting with different formats. So we've done a lot of writing because she's a very strong writer, and that's been doing really well. She's getting great engagement. We've pitched a couple of op-eds to trade publications that have been picked up. We're starting to turn it into a healthcare innovation roundtable series that we're going to try and do live in different cities every month.
That's really cool.
Which is very ambitious.
She's in a different city every month.
The organization she works for has clinics in different states. We're gonna try it for the next 6 months.
Right. Okay.
See if we can pull it off. But being able to, I'm really excited about that kind of thing of being able to explore different formats for the same content.
Absolutely.
And different ways that suit different founders' personalities. There are founders who don't want to be in front of
them. Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But
you kind of have to pick and choose your where are you most effective and how do we, you know, focus the work that you're there, give the other places where your brand needs to be talking and living, but like that's not your lane, you know, as a founder. So
100%. Yeah.
Cool. Want to pivot to a stat that you use on your website, specifically like talking about, you mentioned that 77% of people are more likely to buy from a company when its CEO uses social media, and you say that executive brand is like social proof on steroids, which is a fantastic tagline, by the way.
Thank you.
Want to understand how you're scaling Cursive to reach more of these underrepresented founders and kind of, you know, how are you helping them realize the power of their personal brand? And the social proof on steroids thing.
Yeah. I'll answer the scale part first. Yeah. And that we are keeping Cursive like deliberately quite small.
Yeah.
So scale is not necessarily
growth.
And so I like to be very, very hands-on.
It's great. Yeah.
With our clients.
Yeah.
I have a fantastic, very agile,
yeah,
very quick team.
How big is your team? Just like curiosity, like how small is
it? We sort of fluctuate depending on what's going on.
Exactly.
There's generally 3 to 4.
Yeah, exactly.
So not huge at all.
And these days you can do a lot more with 3 to 4 people who are enabled with all the various tools that are out there.
Exactly.
And also if you know what you're doing, I feel like you can.
You know what you're doing.
That's key. Yeah,
yes. Yeah. And the folks I work with are very senior,
yeah, sure,
very smart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We are all like ruthlessly protective of our calendars.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
We don't have meetings for the sake of meetings.
Okay.
Every meeting has to have an agenda.
That's great,
like
yeah,
all those things.
Yeah. And you're all remote?
We're all remote.
Okay.
So I do want to keep Cursive small.
Yeah.
Like
sure.
I want to sort of treat it as I guess a parallel would be like a talent management agent,
okay,
so that we can really understand our founders and, like we spoke about before, what works for each individual.
So for you, it's not about like growth and scale. You want like a lifestyle business where you want to work with the best sort of underrepresented B2B founders and just help them scale.
Yeah. And there will be a day that they graduate from us.
Yeah.
That maybe they need a bigger full service agency.
Yeah.
And that's fine. We have partners in that will compete with them.
Mm.
We're working with people at very different stages with very different needs.
Mm.
And it works both ways. I kind of handed off clients to a bigger agency,
sure,
and they've handed me clients that they're not quite ready for the full service thing.
Okay. So talk to us about that, because we sort of found that, you know, our sweet spot tends to be tech for good startups and HR tech, health tech, fintech. We're kind of pushing into ed tech and climate tech, but like seed stage series A to start working with them, and then maybe they outgrow us as they get towards, you know, series C or D or something like that. And, you know, charity, you know, executives who they have a certain budget.
Yep.
At least 1 million plus or something like that. Like, how are you building your ICP, your ideal customer profile, and just like honing in on where the best underrepresented B2B founders are?
Yeah, similar sort of stage.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting with Resilient Health, who I've been with in various capacities for going on 6 years now.
Yeah.
I started with them. I met the founders the day after they bought the URL.
Oh, wow.
So I've been able to sort of map out, get a really good sense of what founders need at different stages. I think our sweet spot is probably similar. Pre-seed is a little early.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they're still figuring out their product, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
seed's changing now too. I've heard of people getting multiple seed rounds now, and the seed rounds I feel like are getting bigger is like what I'm hearing. And so like seed is, and I've seen some data about like seed is almost being extended. And it's harder to get from seed to series A is kind of what I'm seeing in the data.
No, I think you're exactly right. And especially in health tech and fintech, which is sort of where we live mostly,
totally.
Funding is harder to get.
Yeah.
The market is still there, but funding is harder to get.
Totally.
And scale is harder to get.
Totally. But a lot of bridge rounds, stuff like that.
A lot of bridge rounds.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But the seed to series A stage is a really interesting stage. And then sort of where, in the case of Resilient, like that was still very much founder-led sales.
Okay.
Like the founder was the sales team.
Okay. Yeah.
It's so the thought leadership and the personal brand that we had for him was very tactical. Very short term, it was very, okay, getting folks into the pipeline, the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And it had to be. Now that the company is post Series A, they have a pretty robust sales team now. So the founder can, or both the founders can zoom out and be a little bit more future looking.
Right, which lends itself to executive branding and kind of, they can, you know, pull themselves,
Yeah, it's a different type of, the content more than the strategy.
Sure.
So we're looking at like, okay, what is going to happen in the industry in 5 years?
Okay.
Rather than like, how does this product affect customers in the next 12 months?
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
So we've been able to kind of restructure that thought leadership and go, okay, we want to position you as like an industry visionary. What I like to do, because founders are very goal-driven,
what
I like to do is find a conference or a big event like in 12 or 18 months and go, okay, we're going to get you on stage.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Say that's Aspen great. Ideas.
Yeah, totally. Like that. That's big. Yeah.
So how are we going to do that?
Yeah.
Like, what are all the incremental
What needs
steps?
To be true? You know, kind of. Yeah.
Exactly. What Op-eds, needs to be true?
You know, webinars, like who do you need to talk to? Who do you need to know? Like that kind of stuff.
And what do you need to be known for?
Ah, interesting. Okay. Interesting.
Like, what do you want to talk about on that stage?
Okay.
And how do we build that portfolio of thought leadership for
you
to lead up to it? That when we pitch you as a speaker, they go, oh my God, of course.
Yeah.
Look at all this great stuff that he's been speaking about.
Yeah.
About.
I think the what you want to be known for is such an interesting question. Like, we have a founder that we work with, shout out to Shauna, who's all about legacy, you know, and legacy is such an interesting, like, rich, like, juicy word. And you know, the work that she does is like helping founders think about it. Actually, be interesting to have the two of you chat. Mm. Helping founders build their legacy and think about what they want their legacy to be. And like, almost like what you said, but even further out, like generations from now, you know, like not just 12 months, what conference stage you want to get on, but like generations from now, what do you want your legacy to be? How do you want to? Yeah, so yeah, it's much more sort of like sort of far reaching. But so we work with her on kind of like how do we flesh out your credentials as the legacy person, you know, and like what does that mean and what does it not mean and like what do we need to be careful of and things like that. So yeah, I find that work really fascinating.
The what do we need to be careful of thing I find really interesting.
Yeah,
like how antagonistic can you be
in this day and age, no less.
And I think, again, individual founders have different appetites for it,
totally, sure,
and different industries have a different tolerance for it. But that's a really interesting thing to find that edge.
Totally. And even I think for the edge, like for us, a lot of founders are sort of like, they want their brand to be out there, but not themselves. And you kind of like, as you mentioned earlier, like you have to get them past that and be like, okay, like, you know, here's the stat, 77%, you know what I mean? Like, we'll buy, you know, buy engaged with your product. And so,
it's, I think it's very culturally different depending on where you are. Like we're recording this in London. But you grew up in the US.
Yeah, totally.
I grew up in Australia and I work in the US. It was a shock to me personally.
Right.
When I moved to the US, I had done a little bit of work there. A lot of my work in Australia was getting startups ready to enter the US market. I kind of walked into the US and went, I know this is so different. So it's interesting culturally seeing Australian and British founders especially coming into the US and having that realization.
You need to get out there.
My personal brand is like directly tied, for better or worse, brand.
Yeah.
And I need to find a different example, but I use Elon Musk as an extreme example of that.
Yeah.
Ideology aside, he's such a powerful example of how a personal brand can affect his company.
Help, like you said, affect and not, like it's help and hurt. You know what I mean?
It's
like as soon as he makes a move, like Tesla stock is tanking.
Exactly.
But other times, you know, he makes another move and it's like, okay, this company is looking really good right now. You know, it's like kind of both. Yeah.
And how, like, what are the CEOs of like tunnel drilling companies do you know?
But is that like, can you argue that the Elon example is almost like an extreme example of like, you don't want your brand to be so sensitive to your executive brand? Like maybe you want like a, this is why you need a better example, but like maybe you just want like a steadier sort of, you know, you want that curve to go up and to the right. Like, you know,
absolutely. 100%. But it's also, it's a very good cautionary tale.
Totally.
Especially when there's been a couple of folks that I've worked with that have been, had more of an appetite to be more of an antagonist. That's great. I want you to have strong opinions and I want you to put your strong opinions out there. Exactly why I'm here. But bigger picture.
And you can do it in a way that like, well, one of the founders we work with in the AI space, like his whole thing is sort of like, I've been in this game for years, like longer than all you AI charlatans who just now arrived at the party.
Sure.
And he's not necessarily attacking like individuals, but he sort of created this straw man, which is not even a straw man. It's a real thing of people just like selling AI snake oil and saying like, that's bad. That's not good. That's not well thought through. And people really appreciate that because they feel awash in all this information about AI and they don't know how to navigate it. I think if you present yourself from another one of our clients, Grapeseed, they present themselves as a navigator in a really complex space. And I feel like that, as an archetype, is such a powerful one for founders.
It really is. AI is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
Health tech, especially in the US, is a great example of that. And then you're layering in, you know, because health insurance is tied to employers and there's different, you know, vendors and direct contracting that's in that. So that's been a really interesting thing to sort of navigate of, okay, how do we best position you as exactly that, the navigator in all this. Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned health tech and you mentioned resilience. So I'd just be curious like how your work at Resilient has like influenced your approach to executive, you know, branding and health tech founders specifically.
That's a good question. And we sort of touched on it before where I've seen the evolution of the company.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And then had to map the evolution of the founder brand.
Okay.
Has needed different things. The company has different resources at different times. Mm-hmm. So founder brand is never a set and forget. And it's never, you know, I have occasionally have people come to me and they go, oh, I need your help, but I'm not going to be like one of your typical clients. typical client.
What's a typical client?
Yeah, what's a typical client? Exactly.
Like, I wish the clients were more typical because then I could just repeat our services. I'm saying that from a cynical place of sort of like every brief feels like a custom brief. And I feel like as an agency leader, like that is quite hard. You know what I mean? Like, because you're having to, but I love it because it's definitely more intellectually stimulating. I learn more, you know, like it's a bit of both. It's bittersweet, I find. You know?
It is. Yes, yes. Yeah. I totally get it on both sides. Yeah. Like you said, like if you could just have a playbook and a custom, like copy paste.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want it to be truly copy paste, but like, I think some of the journeys that founders take us on are so, like, I feel like almost we could be more rigorous in our practice with like, okay, like that's great that you, but like, let's, you know, this has worked over here, here, and here, you know, and maybe that's more a reflection on us, you know, not necessarily like, because founders are always going to bring you their specific special little snowflake situation. And it's like, I think what we learned as a business is like, stand in your power a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, you know what works for branding and for marketing and things like that. And so like, yes, you need to adapt that and personalize that to the founders you work with. But there's still some like tried and true, you know. So anyway, there's lots of debate in the space about that.
You're exactly right. Yeah. And I think that's another reason why I want to keep Cursive very small and very hands-on. And so that we can, like, we do have the agility to experiment and iterate and, you know, throw out what doesn't work, rinse and repeat what does work.
Totally.
For individual founders, but also sort of in broader strategy as well. So it's sort of striking that balance of every founder in every industry and every company is going to be slightly different because there's so many variables in what they're doing. But there has to be, to your point, some rigor for us to survive and for us to deliver a good product and a good service to our clients.
I want to hear a bit more about your journey. So like, you know, you mentioned like moving, you know, over from Australia to the US and the work you've done to kind of build your own visibility, the work you've done at Resilient, now Cursive Media. So like kind of, you know, what helped you come to this realization that, you know, executives need the kind of branding services that you're offering? Like, were there any key moments you want to flag? Like, what were the guideposts along the way, I guess?
Yeah, it was a couple of things. I think when I was living in Australia, I was in some big agency work and I loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I was in my 90s working as an art director, creative director, and like, you know, WPP and Ogilvy and all these big flashy agencies. Yeah. We started taking on, one of the agencies I worked with started taking on startup clients. And the startup ecosystem in Australia is a lot smaller than America.
Okay.
And it was pretty nascent at that stage. We were like, what even is a startup?
Yeah, yeah.
And I realized really quickly a couple of things. One, that I really loved working with startups and loved doing that foundational. Oh. I was very much on the brand strategy side and content side. I loved doing that foundational strategy and kind of encompassing even going into sort of a product marketing role of is there even a market for what you're trying to do?
Right.
And what does that look like? And how do we position you within it? Like really kind of pulling those strings.
Yeah.
I really love doing. And I also realized that big agencies aren't very good at doing that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. because they're not like, they're too big. They're not nimble enough. Like, why aren't they good at that?
Yeah. Exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair. I mean, like I was working on like Mercedes.
Right. And, like, I think that's interesting because like a lot of these like bigger, you know, enterprise, like legacy companies, like, unless they're, you know, like Ford, like I don't know who the founder is or was, you know what I mean? Like, and I don't know who's on the executive team. Like they kind of, maybe you can make the argument that like, you don't, at that level, like the executive team, you don't need them to have a personal brand or like, well, to some extent, I mean, but like there's something about a startup. It's more about startups like that I, you know, like it's so tied to like the founder's journey and like their brand and like, I don't know. It's just maybe because they're so small, you know, and like kind of people, but I feel like for the bigger enterprise companies, it just feels different. I don't know, like talking through that.
No, it is. You're exactly right. But there's an argument the other way. Like again, using extreme examples, Steve Jobs.
Sure. Yeah. That's an extreme example.
Apple started as a startup. Everyone knew who he was.
Yep.
But like he was still the figurehead of that company when it was a huge company.
Totally. Yeah.
Same with Bill Gates.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would think too about like people don't open a Chase bank account because of Jamie Dimon. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like trying to think of what it is about these brands. Like, is it just because those brands that we're naming happen to have like charismatic once in a generation leaders? Like, of course, like we, you know, executive, like, but I'd be curious, like, unpack that and be like, okay, well, what was the executive or founder branding strategy behind Steve Jobs? Or behind, is there one behind Elon other than his own whims? You know what I mean? Like that.
Oh, look, I would have loved to be in the room with you. If those decisions were consciously made, totally, I would have loved to be in the room. And I honestly don't think there is a right answer. Don't think there is a like black and white sort of playbook.
Of course not.
I think there's sort of a mantra in VC is, you know, seed, you bet on the team. Now, seed, you bet on the idea. Okay. Series A, you bet on the team.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I've heard that. I've heard this like A team, B idea. Like VCs will go for, if you have an A team generally, but you have a B idea, like generally they'll sort of play ball or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it is just much more amplified in especially earlier stage startups.
Gotcha.
Later stage startups, I think it's still not kind of a lever that is going to be really crucial to get that early traction. Again, I might be wrong. There is no real playbook.
And have you done any stuff? Do you just focus on the most senior leader? Have you done anything with like leadership teams as well?
Leadership teams are really important.
Yeah, of course.
Because of course the leader, the CEO or the founder is very, it's crucial to position them as the visionary of the company. But like the functional team leaders are just as important.
Yeah.
Like going back to Resilient, we've got the CEO who's very much the visionary. Yeah. And then the COO who's come from a biomedical engineering background.
Okay.
So the stuff that we work on with him is very technical.
Yeah.
It's very, again, we talk a lot about AI and healthcare setting, but it's a very different style and very different flavor.
Okay,
and
gotcha.
It's much more focused.
Gotcha. And have you ever had a situation where you've walked into a situation where you've been asked to do some executive or founder branding and you're just kind of like, I don't think this is going to work. I think this person actually needs to move out for this company to succeed.
I don't make those kind of calls I'm never.
Not publicly.
Ask my wife. Yeah. I don't know enough of the business. Okay. I'm not in the day-to-day of the business enough to be able to kind of like confidently make those calls.
Yeah, sure.
But having worked with startup founders for, 15 plus years in various capacities, either in-house or with my own shop, I've become very good at spotting founders who aren't teachable.
Okay, teachable, yeah.
Aren't coachable.
I mean, yes.
Yes, yeah. You've got to have a vision and you've got to have conviction in your vision.
You got to evolve though and pivot. And
you've got to listen to what's going, what other experts are telling you.
Right. Yeah. Back to the senior leadership team and absolutely. I mean, I feel like it's been one of my biggest, everything that's wrong in the business is an expression of my, lack of learning or lack of willingness to grow or evolve, or I'm not listening to someone in the business who, knows how to fix the problem or empowering them to fix it themselves. So.
And I find it, this is my own thing, but I find it the highest compliment when I hear a founder speaking and it's a principle or a something that I've taught them to a certain extent.
Okay,
and they've embodied and they've processed and put it into their own context and then turned it into their
own.
That's
amazing.
This person they're going to be an incredible leader because they can take that knowledge and turn it into something useful.
Yeah. You're reminding me of I started my career as a teacher, as a middle school teacher.
Right.
There's no greater, and I'd argue intellectual, emotional high than teaching someone something and watching them apply it.
Yes.
There's something about that. It's so human. It's so oh my God, it's almost like immortality, and personified that you're oh my God, I'm going to live forever because I just taught someone something and they're going to teach their kid and blah, blah, blah. And you're just got goosebumps thinking about it.
Yeah. And I don't think it's an ego thing.
No, not at all. It's not ego. No, I mean, I think we've got these mirror neurons. We're wired to help people and to, I'm sure we had ancestors who their neighbor couldn't plant something and we needed to help them so they could survive the winter. That's just in us, interesting. Cool. Well, we're going to move into quick fire questions now and wrap up and talk. These are just fun sort of your first answer that comes to mind just so the audience can get to know you. You've already got Cursive Media now and you've worked with a lot of founders, but if you could start your own tech startup right now, what would it be and why?
I don't know if I would do a tech startup.
Okay. Any kind of startup.
So my deep dark background was actually fine art.
Okay.
I trained as a painter.
Wow. Okay.
I've always wanted to run a gallery, and it's okay. A terrifying, opaque, weird industry that I'm fascinated by.
That's the first gallery answer we've ever had to that question.
Really?
Awesome. No, it's great. Like, we want, because everyone's like, AI, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, fine. But like, that's a great one. That's, yeah. And also, what would that look like and how would it be different in this day and age, if at all? Like, but maybe it's like you said, in-person events as well earlier. Like, people just want to walk in and smell.
There's a tactility that I think we miss a lot.
Totally.
And again, going back to, my personal thing, like, that is my decompression, is going to a museum, gallery.
Yeah, well, if you're enjoying your time in London now.
I'm so spoiled.
Swimming in it, yeah. That's good. What tech invention makes you the most excited?
This is the complete opposite.
Okay.
Blockchain.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And the context, not so much in the cryptocurrency context, but going back to the creative world, blockchain as a smart contract application.
Of course, yeah.
I think there's incredible possibility.
Yeah, art as well, maybe.
Like, art as well, music, being able to bake royalties into a smart contract so that the artist gets whatever, 20%, 15% every time that music is sold or every time that piece of art changes hands.
Right.
I think that has the potential to change the industry completely.
That's amazing. Cool.
Yeah, because you hear so often of artists dying dirt poor.
Yeah, of course. But you can extend that value across their lives or really, because so much gets reproduced or even taken.
It's less that, but it's like they don't get the recognition during their lifetime.
Totally.
It's only sort of towards the end of their lifetime and it's somebody else who has bought that painting is now selling it that is profiting from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The artist doesn't see that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So the flip side of that question, what sort of tech invention makes you the most concerned right now?
Again, probably AI.
Okay. Anything specific about AI? Like what facet of it?
I think we've always, ever since I was a teenager, we've relied on tech. We've outsourced our thinking to tech.
Yeah, totally.
I cannot get anywhere without Google.
Sure. And, same thing,
When was the last time you did long division without a calculator?
Nope.
Exactly.
Didn't even do it when they asked me to do it.
There you go. I think AI is an incredible tool.
Sure.
But I think the potential for us to outsource our critical thinking and for the creators of whatever LLM or whatever it is to rewrite history is already happening. It's really terrifying.
Wouldn't be the first time someone rewrote history. Those monks, man, they were just whatever they wanted, and we just took it. And they didn't have ChatGPT.
Their ability to scale was a little.
Totally. It was a much slower scale. I got to get this scroll to this ship. Who's a literal human who's been integral to your career journey that you want to shout out?
There was a creative director that I worked under in agency land who. Every time, and it was right when I first started as a graphic designer, and every time I would work on a brief, she had this uncanny ability to tell whether I was creating the work to please someone else or whether it was work that I was creating with.
Every single time.
That was
a great skill.
Wow. Uncanny. And I still think of her every time I write something. I still do a little bit of, who am I doing this for?
Yeah.
And it is like black and white, changes my work.
That's really interesting. That might be the best answer we've ever had for that question.
Really?
Yeah, honestly.
Do I get a prize?
We've done 100 in February. we're going to go get lunch right now. But I don't think people always think about the power of really effective mentorship and in specific ways like that. What has this person taught me that, because then they taught you like a way of being, a mindset that you then have taken forward into all.
Yeah. And she was Dutch as well, so very.
We love the Dutch. We love
you knew what you stood.
And they're not mean about it. They're not like the Germans. Yeah, they just cut right to the. They cut right to the. I'm gonna take that out.
Yeah,
no shade on the Germans. My partner's half German, so I can say stuff like that. I have to deal with it. What's an inspirational quote that stuck with you?
This is actually a quote that I need to reframe for the health tech founders that I work with. Yeah. But I had a. I worked with a public speaking pitch coach years ago, and he kept saying, put the body on the floor on the first slide.
Wow. Okay. That's great. Yeah. That's really good.
And I say it to founders all the time. And it's like, I use White Lotus as an example.
Sure. Yeah.
Have you seen White Lotus?
Yeah.
There is the first scene, there is a body on the floor, and you're in.
Interesting. You're in it.
You're hooked and you want to know how
What's the classic story in media res, right? Like you start the story in the middle. It's like a classic storytelling, tactic.
Yeah. Put the body on the floor in the first slide.
Interesting.
Put the most compelling information about your product or your very first slide.
Yeah,
you've
got
7 seconds to get their attention.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, that I'm literally going to take that and put that in a presentation we're doing tomorrow, pitch we're doing tomorrow. It's really good.
So it's
like, because it, like, you can use it, you can like scare a person, you know, you can use fear or you can inspire them. You can, there's so many different emotional, you know, threads you could pull. So,
cool.
Well, listen, I think this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you for flying all the way over here from New York just for this.
I
think the work that you're doing, it really aligns with so much of the work that we do, the clients we work with. So there's so much alignment here. We're going to talk about that over lunch. Surely the stuff you're doing around the power of authentic like storytelling to I think there's so much humanity in it, just like having a person come out of their own shell and, you know, like really own and appreciate their own story. Like that must be the fun stuff
that is absolutely the fun stuff.
And the fact that they get to sell stuff more off the back of that is great too.
That's a bonus.
And I think it really shows how, like, you know, your like creative thinking can kind of just unlock the goodness and hit, you know, the sometimes hidden purposely and not so purposely stuff that's there for people and their businesses. So thank you for doing what you do.
I appreciate it. It's my pleasure.
Can you let listeners know where they can find out more about you and Cursive Media and all the good work that you do?
Sure. We are at cursive.media.
Makes it easier.
Yep. My email address is on there. It's just sar@cursive.media. Feel free to sling me an email, find me on LinkedIn. I'm very open to just even a chat.
Cool. And thanks, everybody. This has been another great episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Little Humans. We were talking today with Sar Rudenklau, the founder of Cursive Media, about building up B2B, underrepresented B2B founders and helping them build their personal brands. Thanks for tuning in, y'all. As always, please give us a review and give us a 5-star rating so we can keep bringing on more great guests like Sar. Thanks, everybody.